Well, a warm welcome to this Shimizu lecture to be delivered this evening by one of the school's distinguished centennial professors, Mark Galanta. Mark is far too well known to require an extensive introduction from me. The range of his interests and achievement is protean. And given the nature of those interests, this School of the Social Sciences represents a natural home for him on this side of the pond. We hope you'll stay with us a long time, Mark. At the University of Wisconsin, which has been his American home since 1976, Mark Galanta is both a professor of law and a professor of South Asian studies. So he's not one of those lawyers who's simply meddled in the social sciences. Early in his career, he spent more than 10 years teaching the social sciences at the College of the University of Chicago, and that was before he became a law professor. Mark's early work was in India, much of it on the caste system and the inequalities associated with it. This work culminated in two important books, Competing Equalities, Law and the Backward Classes in India, and Law and Society in Modern India. This experience equipped him with a steady outsider's gaze when he returned to the American scene. And this led to a series of seminal papers on dispute processes, litigation in particular. Here one thinks of articles like Why the Haves Come Out Ahead, Justice in Many Rooms, and Reading the Landscape of Disputes, all papers that have shaped the area of studies in which they were written. Mark was a legal pluralist and an active observer of the ADR scene long before the rest of us got there. In mid-career, Mark turned to examine the organization and growth of large commercial law firms, writing his admired book, Tournament of Lawyers, with Tom Pallet. And it was the determination to give that study of large law firms a comparative dimension that brought him over to London. At the same time, Marx also moved on, as it were, and his book Lawyer Jokes and Legal Culture, is in press with OUP at the moment. His latest research is Square in the Field of Demography, and that takes him right back to his roots in the social sciences. Mark, it's an honour to have you as a centennial professor at this school, and we're looking forward to what you've got to say this afternoon on the subject Separated at Birth, Large Law Firms in Britain and America.
Thank you very much, Simon. As Simon mentioned, I've spent a bit of time in India, and I hope, therefore, sensitive to the problem of being a visiting scholar telling the natives about their own culture, which always turns out to suffer from insufficient similarity to the scholar's home culture. To the extent, though, that I can avoid such problems, I would direct the credit to my collaborators, Simon and our research assistant, Lindy Marinkowitz. In any event, I hope that my clumsiness is redeemed by the strangeness, perhaps, of seeing your house through the eyes of an outsider. The vision may not be accurate, but I hope the misreadings and distortions will be instructive, or at least provocative. What I'd like to do is compare large law firms in the US and the UK, or at least use them as a starting point for a more general comparison. Now, the large law firm really wasn't very large when it began. In 1890, four or five lawyers was large. But in the late 19th century US, there was a shift in law practice, at least at its leading edge, from courtroom advocacy to office counseling and deal making, from the representation of individuals to representation of corporations and of the capitalists who own them. Now, it may be that the centrality of transactional work, which had always been present perhaps in the UK, but in the US it was new, and by the 1890s it was reflected in the emergence of a new sort of law firm. Before that, leading lawyers, sometimes in small partnerships, were surrounded by juniors and long-term retainers. In time, the juniors would learn the craft and move on, or would resign themselves to a permanent subordinate position. Now, in a break with that pattern that's associated with the name of Paul Cravath, but actually occurred to a number of lawyers more or less simultaneously, in a break with that pattern, a new system was invented of seeking highly qualified law graduates, retaining them to work exclusively on the firm's business rather than beating the bushes for business of their own, offering close guidance and gradually increasing responsibility, and committing the firm to take the best performers into the partnership at some foreseeable point down the road. Now, these new, what I call promotion to partnership firms, arose, as you can see, at the intersection of two new institutions. First, the unprecedentedly large aggregations of corporate capital that enabled the client who controlled such an aggregation to bestow on a lawyer far more business than any single lawyer could handle on his own. Secondly, there was the law school that was replacing apprenticeship as the mode of entry for many of the best qualified aspirants for the profession, and produced large numbers of highly qualified young lawyers with neither clients nor the experience to attract them. So the promotion to partnership firm grew out of this juxtaposition of a small group of senior lawyers possessing the trust of clients who could confer great bundles of legal business with highly qualified junior lawyers with no clients and little means of attracting any. Now, what Paul Cravath and other entrepreneurs did was devise a template for a deal between these overendowed seniors and the underemployed juniors. And the key ingredient of that deal was an opportunity to compete for promotion into the partnership, that is, to acquire a piece of a flourishing business, big prize. This turned out to be the core of a set of incentives that were quite effective in enabling firms to attract and retain highly qualified young lawyers who were highly motivated to work very hard for the firm. It was to the advantage of the firm to promote those juniors with the greatest bundle of human capital. That is, there was a competition among the juniors for promotion, which Tom Belay and I called the tournament, and the tournament deal protected both the senior lawyer from being ripped off by the junior, and to a lesser extent, vice versa. But the firm had a strong incentive to fulfill its obligation to promote some juniors on a regular basis. But this, in turn, this promotion had an unexpected or unanticipated byproduct. It produced exponential growth of the firm, steady percentage growth of the firm, very small at first because the firm's the starting point is are very small numbers, but eventually very sizable. And the reason is that if we imagine this, the firm, each of its partners it works with and is supported by a junior lawyer or some fraction of a junior lawyer. Then if at some point we decide to promote this junior lawyer, not only must he be replaced, but some fraction, or whole additional junior lawyer has to be added to work with him as well. But as if every partner has a half or a one and a half juniors working with him, the addition of new partners means the addition of more juniors, which in turn leads to the promotion of more partners, et cetera. So this firm, these firms grew, but apart from growth, it seemed to me they've been a great success in the sense that they've solved many problems of recruiting and nourishing talent, protecting investment in the relevant sorts of human capital, and provided an effective way to give comprehensive, continuous, sometimes inventive legal service of a very high quality. As it spread, it became the industry standard, emulated in many other practice settings, and eventually in other countries as well. And at the right now, if we look around the world, we can see long-established organizational forms giving way in many places to this promotion to partnership firm, for example, in Germany as we speak. So it's an institutional success story, which I should say doesn't necessarily imply that it's a wholly admirable institution. It certainly deserves credit for having a meritocratic component since its origins, but for a long time that was combined with a very strong strain of class, race, religious, and gender exclusion. Again, much of the work of such firms can be viewed as usefully promoting the development of the economy, but these firms have also been party to many nasty and exploitative doings. And finally, there's some question whether the talented people who spend their working lives in this setting have been as creative or fulfilled as they might have been. Well, regardless of one weighs these matters, I propose that the large firm must be accounted a technical success, like the assembly line or double entry bookkeeping. So starting around 1970, I'm still on the American side of the equation here, starting around 1970, the big American law firms underwent a striking set of changes that can be described as a transformation. They grew in size, they became more highly leveraged, they became less homogeneous, more meritocratic, started to be, the world in which they existed started to include considerable mobility, both individual mobility, individuals moving around, lateral hiring, defections, mergers, the stability of the large firm world was left behind very quickly. The composition of the work of these firms shifted from its historic emphasis on office practice toward litigation and other risk-prone, high-stakes transactions. The enduring retainer relationships with clients that had been the basis of for half a century of large firm practice, these retainer relationships eroded. And the need to find new business led to aggressive marketing as law practice became more openly commercial and profit-oriented, and as people said repeatedly, more like a business. Management of firms became rationalized and hierarchical. The growth necessitated larger numbers of qualified associates, so recruitment activity became more intensified. Starting salaries increased dramatically, as they still are, driving up the shares of all the non-owners, because the second years had to be paid more than the first years, et cetera, et cetera. So, for these more highly paid lawyers, the expectations of hourly billings were ratcheted up, and the rainmakers who controlled large clients were in the ascendant. But for many other senior partners, there was a significant erosion in their tenure and perks. So even as its specific institutional embodiment changed, the promotion of partnership tournament flourished. In the early 1990s, there was a downturn of business, and as a result, firms cut back on their hiring and on their retention of associates. So the number of associates in look at the 250 largest firms in the United States over the period 1990 to 94, the firms actually ended up with about 13% fewer associates. But at the same time, they continued promoting senior associates into the partnership, so that the size of the partnerships continued to increase steadily every year, even while the firms as a whole were stagnant. Starting in 95, the firms started to grow again, quickly surpassed their earlier total. Now, this is a kind of thumbnail sketch of the American setting. Let's go back again to the last years of the 19th century. At that time, the largest law firms serving businesses in the U.S. and in England were roughly of the same magnitude. 4 to 6 partners were the biggest. But they followed these very different trajectories of growth. The American firms organized themselves around providing an array of services to corporate clients. They adopted this promotion to partnership engine, so to speak, and they continued to grow. By 1940, the largest firms had 30 or more partners. English solicitors who did not tend to focus on the same kind of general chaperonage of corporate enterprise and who let a lot of that slip through their fingers to the accountants were organized very differently. They were not built around a promotion to partnership tournament. Offices, even those engaged in the largest business, remained small. Taking 18 firms, which were identified at the end of the last century as the leading firms in London. In 1900, these 18 leading firms had 65 principals at 3.6 on an average. 30 years later, they had an average of 4.8. And actually, all the growth was in half of the 18. The others were the same size or even smaller. So growth was uneven and erratic. Firms fluctuated in size. Progression to partnership was irregular. And once, of course, one became a partner, one kept going. There wasn't any fixed retirement age, nor were there any pensions. There may have been a few English firms that just before or after World War II came to something like the promotion to partnership arrangement that they were familiar with. The high echelon English firms were very much in contact with counterparts in New York. But it wasn't really till the 1970s that this became the general model. The arrival of Euro bonds and of oil boycott proceeds created a new surge of demand. And the demand was there, and the diffusion of educational opportunity in post-war Britain created a new supply. The number of solicitors admitted climbed from 700 in 1960 to 1,800 in 1970 to over 3,000 in 1980. So much larger cohorts are coming in, and as in the late 19th century U.S., the conjunction of increased supply of legal talent with lots of new business created an opportunity to supply legal services on a scale far greater than had been done before. And the established firms, borrowing and adapting the American model, grew to encompass that demand. Regular promotion was institutionalized, firms grew steadily. Simon and I have been tracing the course of the 100 largest UK law firms, 100 largest as of maybe 10 years ago. These firms in 1970 had about 1,000 partners altogether. In 1980, they had about 1,700 partners. So they'd grown, but not spectacularly. In 1990, they had 4,000 partners. Because they more than doubled in that decade, and now they have about 6,000. So very substantial growth is there. And these firms have reorganized. The irregular hierarchy of partner shares has been replaced by a lockstep on which everyone of the same seniority gets the same pay. Now, just as the promotion to partner firm was landed in England, the American prototype was undergoing this radical transformation that I've described. It was becoming the larger, more mobile, meritocratic, rationalized, market-oriented firm. And the English model embraced this in a somewhat modified form. The individualism was dampened by lockstep compensation, by early retirement, and by the discouragement of client attachment to individual lawyers. Now, students of human genetics have enlightened us with studies of twins who are separated at birth and raised in remote and entirely different settings. And the investigators reunite them, usually in an airport. They step off their different planes from different countries where they've lived all their lives, and they come out and they're both wearing purple frocks and have arms full of bracelets. And the shared genetic endowment seems to produce many similar features in spite of the diversity of environments. Well, I think if we look at these law firms, there's two sets of law firms, one born in the U.S. The turn of the 20th century, and then the other in Britain some 60 or 70 years later. Perhaps twins is an exaggeration, but they're certainly siblings. And as often happens with siblings, the process of growing up was more compressed for the younger. English firms, after a long period in a steady state, made a very rapid transition to exponential growth. In the U.S., the transformation to mobile competitive practice came to firms that were already long accustomed to exponential growth. In the UK, the mobile competitive practice arrived at the same time with this pattern of growth. Now, many of their specific features differ, and yet it seems to me they're driven by the same organizational imperatives, so to speak, their genetic endowment. But even in these different settings, where they display many common features, and we could go through a catalog of the resemblances, the high incomes, the differentiation from the rest of the profession, the increasing share of legal business, the increasing competitiveness, the elaboration of specialized management and bureaucratic controls, and so forth. But there's a couple of the differences that I really want to focus on in the time remaining. And let me just start with one, which is the gender and age composition of these firms. In the U.S., about 27% of all lawyers now are women. Here, that's about 35% of all solicitors. And their presence in the world of large firms is somewhat higher here. And that's an area, it seemed to me, I'm just beginning to look into this whole question of the attrition of women, which seems, even though there are more women starting out actually more than half nowadays in larger firms, a smaller number seem to end up being there for the long haul. Now, there was a great increase in young people entering the profession in both England and the U.S. starting in the 1960s, and as a consequence, the average age of lawyers fell. The age structure shifted from a column with roughly equal numbers of lawyers at every age slab to a broad-based pyramid with many, many young lawyers and relatively fewer older lawyers. And only recently, as the number entering the profession has begun to level off, has the portion of older lawyers started to regain its proportionate place. But the English profession is, as a whole, far younger than either the American or than its predecessors of an earlier day. Of course, the population of England is considerably older than it used to be, but the population of solicitors is ever younger. Throughout most of the 20th century, the proportion of solicitors who were more than 55 years old was 20% or more. Actually, during the 1920s, more than a third of all solicitors were over 55. But today, only some 8% of those with practicing certificates are 56 or more. So the average age of a holder of a practicing certificate is about 38. In the U.S., typical lawyer is about 5 years older. Now, 5 years may not sound like a big difference, but when you take a large population like that, it's very substantial. And in many measures, the profession in England is far more heavily dominated by the young. For example, in the U.S., for every 100 lawyers in their 30s, there are 69 lawyers in their 50s. In the U.K., for every 100 lawyers in their 30s, there are only 44 lawyers in their 50s. This emphasis on youth is especially pronounced in the world of large law firms. In both countries, the presence of older lawyers falls steadily as we look at firms of increasing size. This has to do with both leverage, but it also has to do with the sheer absence of older lawyers. In England, large firm lawyers retire early, typically in their early or mid-50s. So that hardly 2% of the lawyers in large firms are over 55. In the U.S., comparable firms, some 6% are over 55. But there's increasing pressure on lawyers to retire or to relinquish many of the rewards of partnership. But the elimination of older lawyers by shortening careers has proceeded much further in Britain. When Clifford Chance and Rogers and Wells combined last year, almost a third of the Rogers and Wells partners were over 50, but only 1/7 of the Clifford Chance partners. So in both countries, the active careers of large firm lawyers are shorter than those of other lawyers and shorter than those of their predecessors. But these are people who are, on the whole, likely to be longer lived, healthier, and more financially secure than their predecessors. Is there life after the large firm? Why do English lawyers so readily relinquish the professional role while Americans prefer to hang on? That is, the senior eminence in his 60s, 70s, or beyond, the type that, I mean, there's so many American examples, that Simon Rifkin, Joe Flom, Lloyd Cutler, one can name them almost endlessly. This is still a familiar American figure, although possibly an endangered species. But in England, it's a species that seems virtually extinct. So what I'd like to do is use these last few minutes for some speculation on some of the more elusive differences between these settings to see if there's some explanation for this. Now, it seemed to me the profession in the United States, and I'm sure those of you who visited there are certainly aware, the profession is suffused with a sense of loss and decline. It's widely believed that legal practice has fallen from a dignified calling to a commercial enterprise stripped of its former republican virtue. The air is thick with laments about the good old days, summed up in the titles of two of the best-known volumes on this, the great sagging shelf of this literature of decline. One is Anthony Cronin's book, The Lost Lawyer. Cronin's the dean of the Yale Law School. Another is former practitioner and ambassador Saul Linowitz's book, The Betrayed Profession. So we have The Lost Lawyer, The Betrayed Profession, and any number of articles and other books sort of exploring these same themes. This theme of decline, I should say, is not a recent arrival. It's actually been around for over a century, since the very beginning of the connection between lawyers and the growing corporate world in the 1890s. British large firm solicitors, in contrast, seem to display a sanguine acceptance that law is a business. There's none of the angst that the profession has lost its way that's so frequently encountered in America. American lawyers feel they've fallen from the eminence of being civic statesmen. On the other hand, it seems to be the upper strata of English lawyers seem to luxuriate in the growth of the complex, lucrative, transactional work and the accumulation of specialized expertise that have changed their relation to the bar. If the American lawyers feel they've fallen, the English lawyers seem to think they've come up in the world, risen from being subsidiary and socially inferior figures. This contrast, I think, marks the different expectations of American lawyers who aspire to a calling of great civic consequence. Earlier this month, I had occasion to attend the graduation exercises at a prominent American law school. The school, I should add, is one that's famed for its devotion to economic analysis of law. However, the dean's charge to the graduating seniors was to go forth and secure liberty and justice, a charge that seemed setting entirely fitting and unexceptional. When I recounted this to the head of a law department of an equally eminent English university, he responded it would be inconceivable for him to address students in those terms. Now, this anecdotal match or mismatch, I think, points to the different senses of what it is to be a lawyer in the U.S. and in Britain. The American lawyer, no matter how mercenary his practice, expects to be regarded as a potential defender of liberty and vindicator of justice. In the words of Paul Carrington, who just wrote a very interesting book on this, entitled Stewards of Democracy. So the American lawyer views, and the American lawyer views those actively engaged in such publicly minded activities as displaying a more central version of the professional role. Thus, you find many of the largest and most successful American firms embrace pro bono projects, set up public interest fellowships, and so forth. Their English counterparts, as far as I can tell, feel no such compulsion. Remedying life's injustices is not the task of the law, but of the machinery of the welfare state. In short, it seems to me the English large firm sector has captured the efficiency and commercial usefulness of the American prototype, but has been quite indifferent to the aura of elevated civic responsibility that continues to haunt the American profession. I think these different senses of the lawyer's vocation reflect differences in beliefs and expectations about the law. Americans regard law as both the foundation of the polity and as a resource to be used instrumentally to achieve their specific goals. Law is seen as an institution that exercises a general oversight over all the various activities in society. Governmental or non-governmental laws, a kind of master orderer. Not always welcome, frequently damned as cumbersome and expensive, frequently resented as intrusive or destructive, but nevertheless seen as, in some sense, in charge in a somewhat inefficient way. And therefore, courts and litigation are major means of settling of establishing norms and standards and settling disputes and policing and controlling other institutions. This image of the lawyer fully identified with his clients, be that a victimized individual or a wider class or even the whole public, this entrepreneurial, innovative lawyer pursuing their cause by legal means in the wider legal political arena, and we just connect those with a hyphen, no, they're not two different places. This is only occasionally present in the reality of what American lawyers do, but it's constantly present as a possibility and an ideal that American lawyers like to think of themselves in. In Britain, on the other hand, seemingly the law is perceived as a well-demarcated, self-contained sphere of activity, and the professionals who are its custodians, for them it's less political, more formal, more rule-governed, more positivist, and so forth. I borrow here from, I think, a very instructive comparison by Patrick Katia. But from this contrast to formal institutions, let me mention that it seemed to be that's accentuated by the images of lawyers that circulate in popular culture. In the U.S., movies and television and thrillers are filled with lawyer heroes defending the weak and friendless, vindicating the rights of the vulnerable, holding powerful wrongdoers to account. I don't know if the TV series The Practice is shown here, but I noticed Aaron Brockovich is showing in all the theaters. If you see Aaron Brockovich or read, say, any of the books of John Grisham, you can certainly get the flavor of this. Wilson's coverage is remarkably favorable. Indeed, one researcher found television portrayal of lawyers not only more favorable than audience perception of lawyers, but even than lawyers' own perception of themselves. It's as if the script writers and novelists of America were engaged in a campaign to popularize the ideal of the lawyer as the nemesis of public enemies. An ideal perhaps not very far afield from Dean Kroman's allegedly lost lawyer statesman. Of course, this coexists, this media celebration coexists with a fierce animus against lawyers, particularly in business circles and generally among the managers and authorities of American society. In what must be a historic reversal of the contours of public sentiment, lawyers are most unpopular among top people and least unpopular, I'd say that rather than popular because they're least unpopular among outsiders and the poor. In the UK, I detect neither the elevated expectations of the popular media nor the bitter condemnation of establishment opinion. In fact, a recent survey showed that public awareness of solicitors is very much connected with their services in conveyancing and other property matters, and only a tenth of the respondents were spontaneously aware of any connection between solicitors and claims and compensation. A dissatisfaction with solicitors focused mainly on their charges. So I think the relative modesty of the solicitor's claims to a public role mirrors a more widespread perception that here that law is not central, it's certainly not the master ordering of all social controls, but a circumscribed realm of formal rules. And consequently, lawyers are not people who wield the great levers of power that would enable them to disrupt our lives or improve them. And I'd like you to end by asking you to consider the contrasting careers of the following little story. This is a story about a doctor, a lawyer, and an engineer who meet at a dinner party and get into a heated dispute over whose profession is the oldest. Well, says the doctor, the Bible tells us about Eve having been created from Adam's rib. That's clearly a surgical procedure, so must be medicine, surgery. Well, said the engineer, that's true, but someone had to be around before that to create the world out of chaos. And clearly an engineer is best qualified for that task. said the lawyer, but who created, where do you think the chaos came from? Now, this is an American version of the story, circa 1990. Yesterday, by total, this is beautifully serendipitous, because yesterday I was walking home and I stopped at a used bookstore in Charing Cross Road, and fortuitously my hand fell on a joke book published in London in 1982 that contained, I won't tell you the whole joke again, but basically it's a surgeon, a lawyer, and a politician, and after the surgeon does his bit, the lawyer says, well, it says God made order out of chaos, which must have required the assistance of a legal mind. And then the politician finally comes through, and it's the politician who created the chaos. So in the British version, it's the lawyer who's credited with the establishment of order, which, while the blame for chaos falls on the politician. Now, since the 1930s, this particular joke has circulated throughout the English-speaking world. Inevitably, the creator of chaos is the politician, sometimes in its early versions, specifically a communist. And politicians remain the primary target in Britain, in Australia, and in India. But in the United States, about 1990, there was a very decisive switch, and the joke switched over and began to be told about lawyers who joined politicians in the public imagination as figures capable of unleashing powerful forces of disorder whose presence represents an entropic drag against the constructive forces in society. Now, jokes about lawyers flow freely across the Atlantic. So why hasn't this one, in the course of 10 years, established itself as a lawyer joke in Britain? I speculate that it's just too difficult for the English to imagine that lawyers possess the kind of power and centrality and destructive energy implied by this joke. It seems to me contemporary Britons don't worry about lawyers upsetting their world and ruining their lives, but politicians. So these separated siblings, it seems to me, demonstrate many affinities reflecting their common genetic makeup, but they've adapted to very different political and social settings that provide lawyers with different roles and different life courses. Will they remain distinct, each reflective of its own legal culture, or should we expect globalization to refine away the differences into a single cosmopolitan, transnational, or post-national legal profession? I would just close by expressing my suspicion that such a convergence is unlikely. It seems to me these legal cultures are resilient. They draw nourishment from many features of their host societies. And my sense is that if we were to come back here in 20 years, we'd still find very, very considerable differences. And let me mention, just in closing, one place where I think the shifting course of large firm development may reinforce the difference in cultures. As I said, the population of lawyers in both countries is aging, and in both countries, the age of retirement, voluntary or not so voluntary, in large firms is falling quite rapidly. Now, what are these long-lived, healthy, vigorous business lawyers going to do with the second half of their active adult lives? My sense is, at least as far as open to correction, is that very few in Britain will see it as an opportunity to embrace the link of law to justice, where my hope, and maybe no more than a hope, is that a substantial minority of American retirees will be enlisted to try to give new energy and force to the notion of lawyering as a public service. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. By tradition, questions follow the Shimizu lecture, and Mark has tactfully left us a bit of time to ask those.
John Flood, University of Westminster. I agree with your basic analysis, and but I don't actually think the twins are rather like two purple pop ladies coming off the plane. Rather, I think they're more like the film with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, twins, genetically the same, but rather different in appearance and so on. And there were a couple of points I wanted to pick up in your interesting lecture. One is I think the difference in part between the way English firms operate and the way American firms operate is that the type of work done and the relationships formed with other professions tends to put one or other group in the ascendant. So that if one were to look at takeover work, for example, it's very much driven by the banks here. Insolvency work, again, is very much driven by the accountancy firms, whereas in the US, you might find the reverse taking place. So that in sort of jurisdictional terms, if you like, the role of our lawyers is often quite different in the UK to what we found in the US. And but also is the nature of the market, which has driven the professions in two different ways, I think. One is the American profession has always had a tremendously huge domestic market, which is why if you actually look at what American lawyers have done, is they really didn't globalize and start getting global or international until quite late on in some ways. Whereas in actual fact, if you look at the histories of a number of the UK firms, they started going international fairly early on and have had to take a sort of longer global reach than the American firms because the UK domestic market isn't that big. Hence the reach out into places like Hong Kong and the Gulf and elsewhere. But even that is changing now, because if one looks at areas of work such as capital markets work, again, the key players are the big investment banks. The big investment banks are American. There aren't any British banks big enough to deal with that anymore. So that the UK firms, to a large extent, have to form alliances with the major US law firms. And so they find themselves in some respects in a subsidiary role there as well. And I suppose until the EU coheres as a kind of single federal unit, we won't see a European mega firm emerge in quite the same way that the American firms have done so. But what it means is that in some ways the American firms have been taken into the global market by their clients, investment banks and so forth. Give them a reach which they typically have. And finally, as regards to pro bono, I don't think you're quite right. If you were to look at the colleagues of mine have done research on pro bono in large law firms and have found that in actual fact they do quite a large proportion of pro bono work. Virtually all the death penalty litigation out of the Caribbean is done by large law firms in London for the Privy Council, for example. So there are long-standing traditions of doing it.
Well, I'm certainly enlightened by these observations, and I think, John, you're right that lawyers do different things here. They're in a different constellation of institutions. I'm not sure I'm persuaded by the death penalty analogy that this is, I mean, clearly it is, and I guess the question I have is who does it? Is it seen as something that we can give young people to, as a basically training exercise and so forth? But quite apart from the exact characterization of that, it seemed to me the image, the lawyer, the sense of what it is that a lawyer should be doing with his life is quite different, and I think it's related to a lot of things, to the educational system, to the role of law in English society, and so on.
Michael.
I think it's very interesting, and I agree with reveal itself as a player in society. That's only just to add a detail, an important detail.
Oh, I think an extremely important and clearly more than a detail, because it's a part of the story that I sort of thought about, just didn't know how to work it in at this point, and I don't know enough about it. But I would say that in addition to the bar, it seems to be part of the story has to be legal aid as well, and the segregation of the legal aid world from the world of the business solicitor, too. That is the development of that as students of the American profession often talk about the two hemispheres of the corporate and individual hemisphere. And it seemed to me that, you know, something like that developed within the solicitor profession here as well, with the development of a separate legal aid sector. And which, in some sense, because government was funding it, sort of relieved the solicitor's profession at large from having any responsibility for this.
One at the back. Sorry.
Professor Gallantown, I work in the context both of the very large American law firm and the British law firm, so I see the two versions. And the American law firm is, as you suggest, something you'll hear on top, you see, much higher average age than the UK, where I'm probably one of the oldest partners, and at approaching 50, thinking about what to do in the second half of my life at the moment. And that takes me to the first two points. And it is that in the United States, there's far greater acceptance of the role of the lawyer in business. The legal advisor in the US firms is expected to take a far more active role in the business aspect of what the client is trying to achieve. And therefore, it is interesting for the lawyers in those firms later in their career to continue and to have satisfying lives beyond the grind of transactional work. That's one critical difference. The second point arises from a historical point, and that's, I'm sure that you will in your research have come across the fact that up until, I think, 1961, UK partnerships were not allowed to have more than 20 partners within. After that time, there was a very sharp growth, particularly in the 70s and the 80s, as you pointed out. And the law firms found themselves, as they approached recession, with large equity partnerships, but with a system borrowed from the United States where they needed to offer something interesting to the lawyers who worked for 7 or 8 years, which was partnership. And the only way in which to provide a continuation was to cut heavily into the equity partnerships, which reduced the average age of these firms. And that created something within the firm that has continued, and the ages have come down in the UK. The US, this did not seem to happen to the same extent. I think this comes back to a point that you've made earlier, simply because there is much more work to be done in the United States. Whereas in the UK, as rightly so before, you had to look much further afield.
Well, I think this is very interesting. The change in the compensation system you describe in England had a parallel in the United States back in the days when the great sort of founding figures who built up big law firms from the early years of the century, but all the way into the 1930s and 40s, as it was only after those people retired or died that you got the so-called lockstep. Originally, you know, there's a famous story, I don't know if it's literally true, but I think it gives you an idea that Paul Cravath presumably was asked by some of his partners his view of some modification in the way they were sharing the profits, and he's said to have replied, "You can do whatever you want as long as I get my 50%. And well, again, John W. Davis, the Davis Polk firm, was said to get 40% of the take. And so there was this era of great sort of lawyer barons who had these huge returns. And in some sense, it was the rebellion of the sons against them who then established the lockstep. In the United States, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and that continued. But when this transformation came in the 1970s, the lockstep gave way. Once you began to get mobility and people, the fear of people taking business away and so forth, almost all firms, Cravath is an exception, there are, I think, one or two other prominent ones, switched away toward a so-called, productivity-based compensation. And of course, it seemed to me one of the interesting things in the UK is that the lockstep, for the most part, has been retained. And there are all kinds of ways, using bonuses and so forth, to try and modify it around the edges, but it still remained the kind of core of compensation policy in almost all large firms.
It's actually a creature in England of the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The system was quite different from there. The system of lockstep was invented in the UK at the time it was being abandoned in the US.
Mm-hmm.
I think one more. Thanks, James Penner.
This is a facile observation, perhaps, but this notion that American lawyers regard themselves as deserving of the rule of the great working with humanity and justice and so on, much higher public rule, let's say, British lawyers who didn't want to go back and work and have their clients on the private and so on. Something that must have something to do with the view, which, I mean, I think as far as I can tell, it's sort of top down in some quantity in American law school, which is that the lawyer is deserving of the American Constitution. And it's like written right in the Constitution in the sense that they did it. Whereas, I don't think anybody says quite that in England, and they teach it to you. I don't know quite, Kent will teach constitutional law, it's sort of a little bit of that deal. And I'm just wondering, do you have any sense that, say, the incorporation into English law, something similar, like the European Human Rights Convention, really not constitutional law, I don't know what you call it, actually. Do you think that would really have any chance of changing the self-impression that lawyers in the country have, whether they're bad or good?
Well, yes, I think American lawyers have a part of their elevated sense of who they are comes from their elevated sense of that they are uniquely connected with the courts. And courts can do all these wonderful things because courts are, in some sense, empowered by the Constitution as the final arbiters of all sorts of things. Now, to the extent it seems to me that England entangles itself in arrangements that make some judicial bodies and applying elevated standards, and the positive law that lawyers deal in then has to be measured against, I think there is clearly it seemed to be willy-nilly you're going down the road of constitutionalism and therefore a kind of judicialization of society, and with that perhaps some change of lawyers' image of themselves. Just a speculation.
Let's continue these conversations upstairs on the fifth floor. Mark and I would like to invite you all to come and have a drink with us in the senior common room on the fifth floor. Make your way through the senior dining room, where a lesser competing occasion is taking place, and into the senior common room. Mark, you covered a lot of ground way, and again, warmest thanks.